Caliente, Emma's Revolution, and our very own 67 Sueños Youth. This wheelchair accessible event is a benefit for the American Friends Service Committee. For more information, visit facebook.com/BayAreaAFSC or call our office at 415-565-0201.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So all moments of time await our dedication to animate the desirable and toss the less than desirable into the composting cauldron. So today, Venus and Mars are getting married. It's the wedding of Venus and Mars in the sky. It's catered by the harvest full moon. So we welcome the return of Eric Davis, science myth wizard, author of Technosis and many fantastic things. Perspicacious, playful, liberating, jaunty, discerning, magical intellect with whom to co-animate the desirable potential of now. And keeper of the hermetic realms, history of entheo sci-fi illusion. Illusion comes from in ludo, in the game, versus delusion, de ludo, out of the game. And discerning betwixt the former, which strives to liberate, and the latter, toxic mimic, which is imprisoning. His website, which is fantastically rich, you know, it's a whole education, technosis.com. So welcome, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me, Carolyn.
Oh, that's great. And I know I cajoled you. I know I cajoled you because I said, I don't know of anyone who has the perspicacious, playful, liberating, jaunty, discerning with whom to co-animate the desirable potential of now. And you said, oh, okay, even though you were very busy. So thank you very much.
No, it was actually a perfect timing. So it worked
out. That's great. Well, you said this great thing, which, again, everything sparks everything. You said that right after the show, or, you know, you were going to go see Blade Runner. And I was like, oh, right. So I went online immediately and got tickets myself in Washington, D.C., going, right, it's the opening, isn't it?
Yes, we're pretty excited. There's a local science fiction bookshop out here in Borderlands, which is a much-loved institution, and they sponsored a sneak preview night. I think the general opening is tomorrow, and so a bunch of science fiction nerds and myself, who is another kind of science fiction nerd, are all gathering, and it should be a rousing good time. I guess the outlook is positive for the film, which is nice to hear. That was an important movie for me, and well, I think a lot of people in my generation, and it will be interesting to see how they bring it forward.
Exactly. No, it's a secret opening, but many places, even Washington, D.C., has a 3D opening. I snarfed up tickets, so we will all be going out to see Blade Runner afterwards, because it is a resonant dynamic. So that's great. And then also, I didn't know that you wrote your thesis on Philip K. Dick until I went to your fantastic website going, oh, look at that. And it was at Yale that you learned about Philip K. Dick, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it's kind of funny. It's just stayed with me for a long time. I think I first discovered Dick's work in 1985, just a couple years after he had died. And then I wrote my senior thesis at Yale on PKD. And then just, a couple years ago, I went back and got a PhD and wrote my dissertation on Dick, as well as some other kind of related thinkers, Robert Anton Wilson and Terence McKenna. So I was sort of writing about visionary experience in the 70s. But Phil Dick has definitely been the longest running interest in my professional career, for sure.
Well, And magic will wend its way, because I learned about Philip K. Dick at one of the best courses I ever took at Brown University on science fiction some years before you. And I go, yay, Ivy League, Philip K. Dick, unlikely alliance. There we go. Okay. And it's poignant also, too, isn't it, that right as he's dying he's about to get rich. He's about to get some money, but he's dying. He's like, oh, no, phooey, right? I mean, because the movies were about to come out.
It's true. He did do a little better in the last few years of his life. It was actually kind of a positive uptick. I mean, he never had a very easy time of it, just being alive on the planet. But he did have a more kind of middle class income in the last few years of his life, as well as some younger fans and interlocutors. So I think he actually was in a relatively good place on the way out. But he had no idea that all the movie stuff was going to happen. He got to see some advanced, some rushes for Blade Runner. I don't think he saw the whole thing, and he was pretty impressed by the world. But you know, he had no sense of how significant he would become to later generations in terms of being seen as a kind of dark prophet of our contemporary media scape.
Well, we do welcome him, as the Venus-Mars wedding is also Trine-Pluto, so we get to invite the dead to the wedding feast, and Philip K. Dick would be there, because we do wonder, you know, and I think invite in, you know, what narrative voices would we like to be, you know, narrating now, the sociopathic madness of now, and Philip K. Dick would be good, Kurt Vonnegut, Terry Pratchett, the unfortunate P.L. Travers, Carl Jung, come on in, so that would be... great, and this resonance with the
James success. Hillman.
Oh, James Hillman. All right, a buddy, and Terrence, a little bit of a buddy. I know we did a show on Hillman 2 weeks ago, and we'll do many more as well. Yeah, exactly. That's great. Let's put him on the guest list, James Hillman.
Yeah, I just read a terrific dissertation. I was on a dissertation committee from a woman at Pacifica, and writing about Dionysus, but she really went into it was about Dionysus and aesthetics, and the way in which the Dionysian is also a form of talking about how we relate not just to beautiful and terrifying works of culture, but just how we experience the world through aesthetics, through feeling, through association, evocation, invocation. And one of the reasons it was, she spoke a lot about Hillman, and I hadn't read Hillman in a number of years, though he was very important to me when I was younger. And still is. It's just that I hadn't spent as much time with him. And what I was refreshed by, and I actually felt was relevant to our moment now, is that he's someone who thinks through richly and productively about pathology, about our own pathology, about the almost, you know, the inevitable pathology of human being, in a way that is both realist, in the sense that he's acknowledging these things. He's acknowledging, in some sense, there's no way out, and you got to like grab the bull by the horns. But at the same time, imaginally bringing in soul, because I think one of the challenges of our moment right now is that, you know, if you without very much effort, you can tap into flows of information and imagery and conversation that are filled with fear and anxiety and paranoia and disappointment, despair. These are all floating around. These are all the dominant tone, I think, in a lot of our worldviews now, even if our personal lives have joy and connection in them. The larger view is pretty dark and getting darker in some ways. And I think a lot of people are, I know I wake up sometimes and I kind of remember what's actually happening in our historical moment. And I feel the sense of like, where was that sense of positivity that I once had about the future? And so I think that we're called to not, you know, avert our eyes from the challenge, from the savagery, from the fear, the disappointment, you know, tremendous disappointment in human beings and in political systems, but not to just through that acceptance just become kind of pessimistic and closed and broken, And so I think that these sort of pathological thinkers, and I think of Dick as sort of a pathological thinker and a pathological writer, meaning that he had his pathologies. They're in the books. You have to kind of move through them as you become a deep reader of his work, that they actually help us live within the sort of pathological dimension of human experience, and accept it, embrace it even, but also recognize that it too is a poem, it too is a teaching, and not simply a literal truth that we have to just buckle down and lose all the multidimensionality of experience. Instead, it becomes another field within which to become more intimate with life and experience. And in a way, we have no choice, but we might as well go through it with open and inspired eyes. And I think Dick's work is really helpful that way, because, you read his work and you're like, this is a bummer. This is not I don't want to live in this world. He didn't want to live in the world of, most of his books, have corporations out of control, madness, the commodification of everything. There's a lot of his characters wrestle with, madness or despair, suicide. So it can be kind of it's like a little bracing, but at the same time, there's a human. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but I also think a crucial part of all those guys, Philip Dick and Kurt Weill, is a dark, liberating wit. Because when we're journeying through the underworld, we want to know that somebody else is seeing, right? And just even to know that Philip Dick is seeing, and then the dark, sharp, liberating wit, I think that's part of what we put into our Venus Mars wedding punch bowl, some dark liberating wit. As Robert Bly said once, nobody ever got grounded by these goddamn California cheerful cults. And Hillman was always about, diving in, and the disappointment and despair, all the dis words. Dis means underworld, where our souls can speak more deeply to us. So we do want to kind of gather our not suppressing, but gathering our plucky jaunty selves, which is why I wanted to have you on the radio. And you can keep going wherever you were going, but I also want to, whenever, bring back, you were maybe my favorite talk at the Eclipse Festival. Well, you and Paul Stamets at the Hub Stage that I don't know if I introduced you, but I was introducing a bunch of people. But it was such a great talk. And whenever you want to get to that about, because it was so deft, about the 60s, all right, the good thing, and then its complicity with the delusional right-wing conspiracy craziness of now. But,
I'm happy to talk about it. In some ways, it's not unrelated to Phil Dick, who in some really important ways was a 60s figure, even if he wasn't a hippie or a part of the youth movement. He was too old for that, but he definitely, was in Berkeley, was, experimenting with psychedelics. He was interested in Asian religion and, very much part of the freak fabric, if you were. And like a lot of science fiction writers, he was kind of navigating between these two kind of categories of a kind of skepticism based in rationality or in reason, and then on the other hand, a sort of opening to the imagination, to other dimensions, to a religious possibility, spiritual possibilities. And while most science fiction writers don't really go to the religion or the spirituality, a lot of the time they are engaging with the irrational, with the mysterious and the unknown. And I think that dynamic now is really spilling out into like a consensus reality. Consensus reality is our term for this world that we share, that's partly a mixture of our own projections and our own perceptions and our own understanding, and then this sort of larger collective field where all of these different perspectives are woven together and mediated through newspapers and television and the internet, and as well as just a kind of common sense about how reality is put together and what the underlying sort of rule set for this reality is. And I think that that rule set and that sense of a collective or a shared reality is starting to unravel in a really significant way. And in some sense, it's always been unraveling in little bits. But I think that we are, with the some of the shifts in media and communications and how people get their news and how reason is deployed, that there's all sorts of crazy things on the horizon.
Right, but what the reason you're so deft, and if we can just maybe do a micro dosing of your presentation at Symbiosis while we wrestle your recording from the Symbiosis recording people. I got Stamets's out and I tried to get yours out. Good luck on that. But it's in there somewhere. But as I was so admiring and happy again, somebody's noticing and guiding in a intriguing and complex way, is that you were touching on everybody's favorite conspiracy theory, but so deftly as to not engage in any needless, you know, polarity. It was really a great dance. But you were bringing up as you just did. But I want to put it on our work table for everybody. Going, the good thing that we thought about the 60s into 70s, which is very resonant with now. Venus and Mars are getting married on top of the Uranus-Pluto conjunction of the 1960s, and so there's a hum, you know, different wedding guests from the dead who are here. But that idea of the, you know, the initial liberating impulse then turns into a reactivity rather than a response of rejecting all authority, all, you know, all science, all New York Times reporting, all finna, and then you gently guide us into the phantasmagoria of illusions and delusions of now. Is it fair to say, to distill from your talk, that reactive, original liberating turned into reactive imprisoning is a kind of lineage and complicitous with the crazy right wing conspiracies of now in the collective field? Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, I mean, I was partly inspired by a book that just came out. Kurt Anderson wrote a book called Fantasy Land, he has, for those who don't want to read a whole book, he's got a fat excerpt on the Atlantic website, which is quite worth reading. And his basic argument is that part of the, he lays part of the blame of the current explosion of conspiracy theory and anti-science positions, and the sort of multiplication of disagreement and the lack of consensus about basic fundamental journalistic practices or scientific claims, and the sort of rise of a kind of conspiratorial skepticism. And he's sort of trying to figure out, where did this come from? And he has kind of two answers. One is that it's always been part of the United States, and this I completely agree with him, that the United States has always had a peculiar quality of a sort of self-making or reality-making that's encouraged, that is, you know, partly explains the vibrancy and the kind of dynamic new world cultural crafting aspect of things, but also feeds into hucksterism and self-promotion, just straight out lying and prevarication is sort of an active part of like gaining attention. You know, he talks about people like Buffalo Bill, who was, you know, actually in the West, killing Indians and doing other nasty things, and then, you know, be kind of turns himself into the sort of a reality TV star by becoming Buffalo Bill on the circuit, on the entertainment circuit, and the way that entertainment has entered into truth and fact in American history. And then you add in all the crazy religious stuff, that this has always been a land of religious reinvention, and that part of the structure, the very structure of the country, with the First Amendment protecting the freedom of religion, and with the tax code encouraging people to, you know, that there are some very concrete gains to be had from having a new religion, that between those two things, it means it's just been a festival of crazy religion. And I love crazy religion. I mean, I'm fascinated with it. I'm more likely to be fascinated than horrified, even by cults and obsessives and crazy conspiracies, just because that's sort of my temperament. But I have to realize that Kurt's got some truth here, that it's partly by allowing that side of American culture to reign that we find ourselves in the current situation. But the other thing he blames our current woes on is the 60s. And for him, he means sort of two things. One, he means Of course, the youth culture rebellion and their turn to magic and the supernatural and psychedelic drugs and fuzzy thinking and just the sort of resistance to rationality, which was seen as some kind of part of the military-industrial complex. Part of what was what brought us to Vietnam was rationality as a kind of institutional form. And it's true that that's an important part of the 60s, but he makes a lot of mistakes, and I'll get back to those in a second. So that's one side of it, is the whole youth culture, psychedelic, mystical, occult revival thing as a way of questioning rationality and questioning conventional sources of authority. And then the other thing he blames that arises in the 60s and the 70s in particular is the kind of new forms of humanities thinking, where humanities in the humanities and the social sciences to a great degree no longer think of themselves so much as scientists who are just speaking the truth, but are instead starting to question, well, what is truth? What is social norms? Where do they come from? Isn't society kind of a social construction? And so people start asking these questions, and as they ask these questions, they grow more and more critical of dominant tones. And right now we're in the midst of that kind of conversation where people are like, look, this whole Western civilization thing, this whole American thing is really just a form of racism and oppression and imperialism and blah, blah, blah. So why would we even begin to adopt their values, including the values of science and rationality and to some degree journalistic credibility? So Anderson believes that the growth of this sort of humanities, which leads into postmodernism and this whole question of, you know, everybody has their own perspective on reality. There's no dominant truth. There's no dominant story, that he blames these people partly for creating this environment that, while it was fairly progressive and lefty for the most part for many decades, has now in some sense been seized by the right, where the right is the true counterculture, where the right is the hard right is offering or taking advantage of the now wormy foundations of traditional forms of authority as a way to disrupt consensus reality and exploit the gaps and fissures and cracks that are opening up in order to sway whole populations, to change elections, to attack what they see as this kind of dominant multicultural ideology that they believe is eroding, you know, America's values, should, et cetera, et cetera.
And we should remember or know that Steve Bannon is actually a fairly informed, in a very dark wizard way, esotericist. He spent years studying esoterica as well as Zen Buddhism as well as other things. So this is a dark wizard who knows about symbols and things, right? Not just an ordinary unripe doofus and a kind of informed in a bad way. Anyway, we just want to put. I was surprised to see that going. Oh, okay.
No. He's a very very smart and a very well read man. He actually has some. I won't exactly call them friendships, but he has corresponded with some people that I know because of their mutual interest in esotericism and in another instance, their interest in games. And he is also, you know, he has a certain kind of perspective about the sort of, you know, Christian West. That has a lot of, you know, power to these days. You know, that's part of the secret history of what's going on with the total transformation of Russia in the eyes of many American conservatives. You know, 20 years ago, let alone 50 years ago, the idea that a sizable block of America's conservatives and hardcore conservatives and Christian conservatives would be pro-Russia, even after the Soviet Union, is just impossible to imagine. And yet it's true. And part of the reason it's true is that Russia, under Putin, has gone out of its way, especially towards its own population, to represent itself as a defender of the faith, where Orthodox Christianity is supported by the government and other forms of Christianity and very much other forms of religion are suppressed, sometimes quite dramatically. And so for a certain breed of American conservative Russia is now seen as sort of a defender of the faith, that the Trump and Putin together are like knights of the faith. And this this vision is so peculiar to those of us who are not part of that narrative. And yet it's important to remember that in some ways, these religious narratives are back in our face. You know, they are actively creating and reproducing their perspectives in the wild melee of consensus reality now. And, we might want to think of ourselves as being secular. I'm not saying, entirely secular, but the secular story is only one little tale right now. And it's not just because of Islam and militant Islam. It's also, because of militant Christianity. So it's all the gods are out. All the gods are out. And my point, you know, I'm just riffing here, but I'm just going to keep going. what I was encouraging people to do, you know, was I saying, look, all of this stuff is true. And conspiracy theories are very attractive. I think some of them are true in a literal sense to some degree. But more importantly, they are often true in an allegorical sense, that they speak to problems, symptoms, pathologies that are in the body politic, and they may not do it literally, but they do it symbolically. And there are also places for people who are powerless to find a different kind of power. But it's also true that if you follow people who really get into conspiracy theory, you recognize that a lot of them are really behaving like religious people, that there's something very similar about being converted to a religious faith and being converted, let's say, to whatever. I mean, the point about one of the tricks about talking about conspiracy theory is you can't get into particular ones too much. You have to acknowledge that while there are significant differences between Comtrails, 9/11 truther stuff, lizard alien overlords are actually running, you know, European governments. You know, these are obviously different kinds of stories, but they share patterns and they share sort of sociological patterns. And there's something very attractive about them, particularly when reality is falling apart and when people have reasons to distrust media, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, that is why we want to bring the wise discerning. Like, even when you bring up Kurt Anderson's book, Fantasyland, really useful. And, you know, and I keep meaning to read Herman Melville's novel, The Con Man, because I know it's important. But I did see Kurt Anderson on with Bill Maher, and he does lump, we want discernment, because he goes, and the problem is all those people smoking grass lost their discernment. We go, not so fast, Kurt. It's more complex than that. We want to come back to that thing, too. Discerning again.
Yeah, let's ride with that one. I mean, for one thing, Kurt gets the history wrong. And people who study, like one of the first great writers on the counterculture, the guy who coined the term, counterculture in the making of a counterculture, Theodore Roszak, our, you know, Berkeley professor, he really emphasized the way that the youth movement rejected rationality, and that for them, the embrace of the supernatural, of drugs, of UFOs or whatever, was part of a politics that rejected what was seen as complicit use of science and technology to oppress and to commit violence. People who study the 60s now, like actual historians of the 60s, recognize that while that is true, it is a deeply flawed picture of what was actually happening. That while there was an embrace and an interest in altered states of consciousness, in other dimensions, in possible other worlds, in ways of being that were not driven by rationality, all of those things were obviously going on. But at the same time, there was a great deal of sort of freak science and freak tech. The Whole Earth Review, for example, was a very obvious example of a can-do, pragmatic, down-to-earth, let's make it happen, let's build stuff, let's create new social structures, let's create a better form, ways to deal with gray water and you know, whatever, all the sort of know-how that went into the commune movement, that went into alternative media. There were tons of hackers, technologists, bright thinkers who understood science and technology, but were influenced by these other dimensions or these other possibilities, social, psychological, spiritual. And so it's really a cartoonish portrait of the counterculture to see them all as like, you know, pot-smoking mystics, for one thing.
Right. We're going to take a very short break with Taj Mahal, just a riff. This is KPFA. This is the Visionary Activist Show. I'm Caroline Casey, and our perfect for now and for all time guest is Eric Davis, E-R-I-K Davis. His website, which is rich, delving, and reading forever, fantastic stuff, is technosis.com. And we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. She shot his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Off him down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com, and our splendiferous, perfect skookum guest, skookum meaning connected to the spirits and completely competent for the work at hand, is Eric Davis, whom I think of as a science myth wizard, author of Technosis and many fabulous things. His website is technosis.com. And you were just bringing up, yes, our discerning, you know, what is liberating and what is imprisoning. And sometimes the imprisoning is a toxic mimic that glitters, and Americans have had a hard time distinguishing between the con man and the liberating trickster. But I'm glad you brought up the Whole Earth Catalog, because that was, for many of us, you know, 1970, so much going on. You were just a young person moving into the field here, but it was at Andy Weil, Dr. Andrew Weil's salon, where I got to be the kind of teenager who hung out with really cool people doing responsible entheogenic research. But we would read the Whole Earth Catalog and check out everything. It's where I read, you know, a lot of Jung and Joseph Campbell and Heinrich Zimmer, The King and the Corpse, and intelligent gnosis, right? Intelligent I Ching, intelligent Taoism, you know, the rich renaissance of a fertile kind of dynamic and astrology and divination, master symbolic languages spoken of with informed intelligent curiosity. And I was like, that's where I'm going. Okay. But yes, absolutely. And also what you said about, you know, everything as it comes up, we go, is this the thing or the symbol of the thing? You know, that everything is part of a collective dream. But, you know, so that, yeah, so you're guiding us in discerning. So yes, Kurt Anderson's book, Fantasy Land, good, you know, and then we take three drops of that with also, he's pretty straight. Perhaps he needs a little more entheogens in his mix, but going right, and that any, well, let me toss it back to you. Anything can be used. You know, many people think Mormonism was, you know, somebody's salvation complex on mushrooms, going, well, I seen the thing, you know, that we're learning now, just because somebody takes a great deal of entheogenic sacraments does not necessarily make them anything.
I mean, doesn't necessarily put extra holes in their head. I agree with that. You know, there's a famous G.K. Chesterton line that looms over all this, and Chesterton, of course, was a conservative. He was a Catholic, and he believed that modernity in turning away from religious truths was just setting itself up for a lot of nonsense, craziness, and perhaps even a disaster. But he was a very clever and congenial character. So I'm actually a fan. I tend to like Catholic conservatives in some ways, because they offer very peculiar but very riveting perspectives on the modern condition. And one of the things that Chesterton famously said was that the problem with the contemporary world is not that people don't believe anything anymore. It's that they believe everything. You know, it's that belief, when it moves away from the traditional forms of Christian belief, at least in terms of the West, it's not that it's followed by this pervasive skepticism. Some people have that. But the problem is that then there's all this myriad of new forms of belief to get completely jazzed by. And that's part of the problem with how we narrate the 60s, is that the more colorful and extremes are in a way more memorable. You know, the people who just lose themselves to drugs and crazy acid visions, or the people who enter cults and believe and worship, you know, Indian gurus or channel beings from the Pleiades. But what we forget are all of those people that you were describing, where there is a you know, there's reason, there's understanding, there's a knowledge, there's you know, wisdom from the past that's being brought to on some very real problems about how the reality itself just ain't what it looks like. I mean, you know, it's not like those post-structuralists and those humanities people were just making up a lot of crap. Some very weird things about how we tell stories about who we are, what reality is, what the world is. And the closer you look at those stories, the more things get wiggy, because the mythic is always ready to bust on through. And once you get the myth out in the room, once it's in loose in the world, then things are just not altogether rational. And you kind of have to learn how to dance with that, but you don't have to hand over your belief. And the way that I've come to think about this, and that was really what I was trying to do with this talk, is to say, hey guys, I totally understand why probably a lot of you are into conspiracy theory or into radical critiques of conventional reality, or you believe that the Amazon forest is speaking through ayahuasca, or you believe that chemtrails are being used to control people's minds, or whatever the thing is. Okay, I mean, it's part of our world. We're going to be juggling with this stuff, you know, whether as a society and even individually, whether we want to or not. A lot of people are into like one conspiracy. You know, there's like, they mostly think things are the way but there's one where like, yeah, that's the one where I'm really sure about. And it's funny to ask people, because you find the people who you wouldn't even think are into it, there's usually like one or two. And it's almost like a place where we keep our kind of pathological need to question, to undermine the structure of reality, to get some sense of space, or to help explain the kind of chaos and confusion. And as I said, sometimes they're closer perhaps to the historical truth than the mainstream story. But so I'm like, the point is not to say all this stuff is crap and stop paying attention to it and only read the New York Times and, you know, Scientific American. The point is to develop discernment. And one of the ways I was thinking about that is that from a mythic psychological point of view, an archetypal point of view, you know, archetypal psychology embraces the multiplicity of the psyche, the fact that we have multiple beings and personalities within us. We have the lover, we have the fighter, you know, to bring Venus and Mars into the story. It's just like the planets. We have an inner Jupiter, we have an inner Saturn, we have an inner Hermes. We have all of these characters, and part of psychological richness is developing a way that these characters can kind of speak to each other, come forward, know when to step back and, you know, take a chill pill, like, and not to dominate. You know, we don't want to be dominated by an archetype. But being a true believer is being dominated by an archetype.
Another way to put it,
balance
is,
you know, out.
When you say, you know, not surrendering our belief, it's not outsourcing our autonomy, but ladling. I sort of want to keep the marriage reception, the Venus and Mars wedding catered by the harvest full moon, kind of going, what do we want to put in the punch, and who do we want to invite as guests? And so in the punch, we do want creative suspicion. You know, as a liberating dynamic, you know, that's part of the discernment, because it was also, you know, as we all track back through our lives looking for clues, I think in eighth grade, I wrote a book on, I wrote a report on psychedelic literature, and the minute I read the Life magazine thing that said, LSD doesn't change you because after you take it, it's not you anymore, I was immediately going, man, if the reality police is saying this, I must find some immediately. You know, it must be really great. So I think that's true. But anyway, so creative suspicion as a response, that we might say reaction is imprisoning, responses and a multiplicity of perspective is liberating. Yeah, is that, can we put that in our wedding punch?
Very much so. I mean, the way I think about it is that when you, as you cultivate your internal garden of you know, myth forms, so that you're kind of aware when the lover's taking over, when the fighter's taking over, when the wizard is taking over, when the trickster's taking over in your own, you know, or temporarily putting on the hat, that in this sort of garden of characters that we're cultivating, we should have the skeptic. And this is not the mean skepticism of a Richard Dawkins. You know, it's actually, unfortunately, it's a term that has been abused such that I'm almost hesitant to say it, because contemporary people who identify as skeptics tend to be, are often ideologues of science. They are extremely narrow-minded in many ways. They are not true skeptics,
and
can actually say
that. Own principles. Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
And they're religious, frankly, about their rationalism. But true skepticism, going back to Greece, I mean, when I say true, I mean like its original form in philosophy, is much more about holding beliefs lightly, and it's coupled with a great deal of pragmatism, a very empirical sense of our place in the world. And that was what I was encouraging people to do, is not to not question dominant stories about reality, not to avoid exploring alternatives, but to recognize that human beings have a tendency to get, in a way, overtaken by abstractions and by stories and by convictions, because it's very safe to believe that now you know that there's something up with contrails, or that NASA didn't land on the moon. Now you know that, and that knowledge gives you a certain kind of power that's very seductive. And what I was counseling is to, instead of that, is to begin to kind of cultivate this inner skeptic who's not, doesn't get to, you know, issue vetoes all the time, but is allowed a certain veto power. So if you're getting, you know, overly ensorcelled, and you know, you can see this happen to people emotionally. I mean, we've all known people who get into conspiracies or things, and they get sometimes they get very, you know, overwrought. And dark and obsessive
and single issue. I love that one of the earliest definitions of skeptic, you know, Miguel de Unamuno, he says skeptic does not mean him who doubts, but he who investigates or researches, as opposed to he who or she who asserts and thinks they have found, right?
Beautiful.
So, yeah, so anything that goes, yeah, certainty's a booby prize all over the place. You know, we throw certainty into the cauldron and ladle out, you know, investigative researching and the journey of always learning, as opposed to this is it and we are part of the elite. And yeah, which is, I mean, my discerning is, you know, that it's a sneaky form of colonialism, because we are pattern tracking beings in beautiful ways. You know, opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic. We must have beauty and pattern tracking. You know, but there's also something. Let me throw it back to you, because I segued myself off of the message. But yes, back to you. I hand you back the talking stick, Eric.
very well. I think part of that point is like, how do we, develop that investigation on our own? Because obviously there's only so much we can do on our own. And there is this part where you have to make a decision between different authorities, let's say, who are saying different things. And part of what you're developing is like, well, based on what I actually know about how the world works, then how likely is it that one of these is more true than the other one? We have to get into this realm of thinking in terms of probabilities, in terms of what's more or less likely. And that's part of the skeptic too, is not that you're not thinking on the real possibilities. I mean, maybe there are, you know, Aliens Among Us or, you know, whatever.
Maybe,
crazy.
But I remembered what I threw in the air, and now I've caught it again. Thank you very much. You know, just to put some discerning on our, some vetting standards on our collective work table, the sneaky form of spiritual colonialism. So anything for me, that is special chosen people of any sneaky, you know, Old Testament and or New Age fantasy about, you know, we, but reptile people, we, but, you know, the right away I go, colonialism, flag on that play, you know, it's a con, you know, into the cauldron. Again, anything that's, you know, we, the 144 chosen people, and, you know, I think part of that go, whatever your crazy, you know, hierarchical, self-inflating mythology, welcome, we need everybody, welcome aboard, here's a vision that we're doing. But there is a lot of so I go specialness, I think, is, and chosen people, I think, is that's where I put the discerning going. Is this a form of
spiritual? I think that's a very good thing to look out for. It's also interesting that you see that often in right wing language, is that there's a certain point where right wing language needs to demote other human beings to animals or monsters or machines or zombies or whatever, that there's
or demote animals for criminy's sake
as well. Yeah. But we know to take people out of that of the human cat to make the boundaries of the human more narrow than the human species itself. And that's a very important way that you create an us against them structure. And that's what's one of the things that's so difficult about a lot of conservative cultures in America, is that oftentimes within the culture itself, like if you are inside the boundary, there's actually a lot of goodwill, there's a lot of care, there's a lot of you know, good values that are operating within it. It's, you know, it's not like they're all you know, stomping in lockstep like Nazis, you know, and that's part of, like, we think of Southern hospitality, et cetera, et cetera. If you're inside the circuit, there's actually positive values there. It's just that the circuit gets defined in a way that needs to other people. And when that gets installed as a political system, it's incredibly violent and suppressive, and it creates all of these other, you know, issues, and it's fundamentally ethically suspect. But there's powerful ethics in it that are actually kind of positive, that sometimes, in some ways, people on the left in the multicultural cities with all of this diversity, et cetera, don't necessarily have. So we're in such a difficult place because everybody has a little slice of the pie, but it's not very well distributed at this point. I mean, it's really quite a confusing time.
Right, and I do also want to go, you know, it's like, you know, conversing with Hillman, too, going, those who cultivate intimacy with the power of symbols have strategic cultural advantage. And he was like, who said that? And I go, I said that. And then we were off and running. But the appropriation, who's telling the story? Who's narrating? Who's got the symbol? So we have the Grail legend, right? And it's degraded into its lower astral form into, you know, Trump holding up the golf bucket, the golf thing as a toxic mimic of, and going, I dedicate this to the people of Puerto Rico. We go, and then I just want to put on our table, too, you know, remember Trump talking murder smack about how he could step out into Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody point blank and he wouldn't lose a single supporter. And I go, that's part of the memosphere. It's like that leads to the Las Vegas shooter in my mind. You know, it's an ancient saying that, you know, the one chicken that the king, you know, steals, you know, his murderous troops, you know, lift 500 and loot the whole village. You know, I go, this memosphere, what the collective mind of what is encouraged, and then back to you, you know, as a esoteric pragmatic mystic scholar, you know, how do we then be an antidote, you know, to put into the memosphere that which draws forth what is best in humans, which is part of the Neptunian, we're all in this dream together, and now we draw forth, you know, through history and, you know, and always the history of heretical free-thinking people, and then even into the 60s, you know, into now. How do we then, you know, into the memosphere and the power of radio? You've written great articles and quoted Terrence or Marshall McLuhan on power of radio and everything. Here we are, you know, to spiral in, like even now, you know, to spiral into the memosphere, you know, expanded human mind, you know, that which is available for download that is sane and reverent and informing and so on like that. So
yeah, I mean, I can, it's a conundrum. And I, one thing that I have come to learn is that you can only go so far with beliefs about how other people are operating inside of their own realities. It's kind of like the way that you can't really know, you know, even if you're friends with a couple, you don't really know what it's like to be that couple, interact, the what works, what doesn't work, what's pathological. It's very hard to judge even people you know intimately. So how much harder is it to judge how people are holding various ideas? You know, it's easy, especially given what we were just saying, how, you know, we all want to draw boundaries around us versus them and, you know, create the tribal resonance, which partly requires having somebody outside the tribe to compare it to. And so it's always easy to say, oh, they are stupid, or they reject science, or they're just, you know, feeding the id or whatever it is. And yeah, it looks like that's kind of true in some ways, but it's hard to really know about other people. So all I can do when you ask a question like that is just try to do what I'm doing, because I can't really control anything, you know, beyond that very much. So I keep these conversations going. What I try to model in my podcast, Expanding Mind, and what I try to do, you know, in my books, maybe in a little bit more scholarly ways in some cases, but in other ways in a accessible kind of writing, is just to model the capacity to be in the midst of these possibilities, esoteric, mystical, conspiratorial, supernatural, but maintain that kind of rational, or not reasonable, I prefer than rational, reasonable, pragmatic, empirical kind of approach as a way to spread not an idea, not a movement, not a concept, not an abstraction, but a way of being, a way where we're very aware of our own processes, we're very empirically grounded, we're self-aware about our own histories and how they shape how we perceive reality. We're very attentive to, we pay attention, we look at other people, we get senses from other people, from texts, we read widely. You read conservative writers, you read radical writers, you get a sense of this larger composition that's going on, and develop the trickster's, or the really the more Hermes ability to dance between models, as a way to not get stuck, and as a way to keep open the possibility of real communication with people who aren't like you, who don't buy your sort of underlying axioms, and also to heal the tendencies within this kind of mystic psychedelic current that comes from the 60s and from before, you know, going back to however far you want to go back, that within that it's really important to balance out and to resist the tendency for people to become true believers, to become part of cults, to get taken over by an archetype, getting taken over by, have a religious conversion to some kind of wild idea like that. In general, is not to be supported. It might happen. It might even happen to one of your friends. It might even happen to you. But the goal is that you sort of erode that kind of enthusiasm and bring it back to a more mixed, pragmatic toolkit world where we're able to interface with the irrational, with our own demons, with the demons in human history, with the terrors online, with the false stories, the fake news, all of that. Like we can recognize it. We can move and even dance with it, but we don't get absorbed into the kind of emotional, you know, resonating ohm of complete acceptance. We keep some resistance and some criticality in our movement. That's what I'm trying.
Some discerning colleagues and ancestors, you know, Jung said that fanaticism is always shouted down doubt, which is a fun thing to keep in one's backpack, going, oh, there we go, there's a good discerning thing. And I think also just, you know, we keep fluid and experimenting. I think another pause button is the use of the term they or those people, you know, into the cauldron, as opposed to going we. Because part of the positive entheo experience, you know, which is not delusional or inflated or given to chosen people, is it is all kinned. You know, this is from endogenous entheo, just, you know, plain spiritual common sense, going everything's alive, everything's besouled, everything, you know. The entheo that that we're all in this dream together, and then science chimes in and says, you know, when people do something altruistic, it creates a cascade of endorphins, you know. And so we go, right. You know, altruism is self-interest. It's, you know, on a biological and spiritual level, it all works together. And this is kind of the wedding of what's been falsely estranged that you've been dedicated to for so long, which is, you know, to have intellect and myth and esotericism in a happy reunion again, right?
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, it's a reunion like a family reunion where there's, you know, cranky Uncle Bob over there, and you know he's going off again, and then, you know, some of the guys are in fights and whatever. Like, it's, you know, it's not necessarily hunky dory. I'm like Hillman. I'm very resistant to sort of false hopes of unity and excessive consonance and harmony. My experience of the world is that it is a pluriverse. There's multiple ways of looking. There's multiple domains of reality, and where they all come together is very hard to define. In that it's good to be able to move between them again. But, you know, myth is definitely part of it, because I look at myth, I mean, to speak not supernaturally, not spiritually, to speak kind of in a more secular way, is that we're all pathological. We all have pathology. We're partly made of pathology. It's part of the human condition. It can be, you know, intensified. It can destroy you. But on some level or another, we all have that, and it's part of what makes us creative and at least it can be worked towards that, those ends. And that myth helps us engage that side of it, gives us sort of like an interface to go into the cavern, or it gives us like some costumes that we can wear that give us a little shamanic pizzazz as we wrestle with our own demons. As well as the demons in history, which aren't necessarily our own, you know, and that's another kind of domain of it. So I think myth has a very practical use as a way to engage the irrational or engage that which eludes our more crisp and clean scientific ways of being.
But when they were in harmony, the originating tracking of patterns, you know, science and pattern tracking, you know, myths, fairy tales, symbolic languages like astrology, are where cultures symbolically embedded their actual science in order to pass it on. The tale of Rapunzel is incredible amounts of biological history. The Anonymyth is the Venus astronomical cycle. We're on our way out all too fast here. But again, when they got split up, then the boys' team said, we don't need, you know, this mythic, you know, moral sense that knowledge be used in dedication to collective well-being. And here we are, re-wedding them again. So you are a great ally, Eric Davis, again, whose website is technosis.com, in the re-wedding of intelligence and esotericism and discernment and positive skepticism and mystic, entheogenic, ecstatic experience as well. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks a lot, Kellen. I had a blast.
That's excellent. All right, wonderful. CoyoteNetworkNews.com, also launching Patreon today in its little incipient form. Caroline Casey, Visionary Activist Show. You can find it there. Follow me on Twitter, Stand Up Coyote. And do check out Eric Davis's fantastic website, technosis.com, and we will reconvene next week. Thank you, team. Thank you, Erica.
Be sure to catch Apex Express on KPFA. Apex Express is a weekly program following news and cultural events throughout Asia and the Pacific Islands. Find out about issues affecting Asian American and Pacific Islander communities locally and globally. Get on board the Apex Express Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. on KPFA.
David K. Johnson is the New York Times reporter, a Pulitzer Prize winner, who wrote the recent biography, The Making of Donald Trump. He is now following that with the compelling, disquieting, What Donald Trump is Doing to You. Drawing on 30 years of closely studying his subject, Johnson promises to disclose Trump's actual impact on our lives. Hosted by Brian Edwards-Tiekert of KPFA's Discerning Upfront Show, Johnson will be here Thursday, October 19th, 7:30 p.m. at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley. Wheelchair accessible, this KPFA benefit might remind you to renew your passport. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com and the customary independent bookstores. October 19th. Tell friends.
And you're listening to 94.